everything that's seen in tradition, some of these might be apocryphal. Rav Zusha never really absorbed a lot of lessons from the Maggid. And the reason is because as soon as the Maggid would start talking, Rav Zusha would become ecstatic. And he wouldn't be able to listen. In other words, when the Maggid would read a verse in the Chumash, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe le'Amor, God spoke to Moses. He didn't even begin expounding the parasha yet. So Rav Zusha would say, oh, the God that God spoke to Moses, what, how wonderful that must be. And he was so ecstatic and in a trance, he never heard any information. So Rav Zusha, as it were, at least is not recorded as a great theoretician of Hasidus, but certainly as a folk hero and a very well-beloved. And of course, you have to understand, when Hasidus spread, it spread among the masses precisely much more because of these role models than it did because of the academic literature that it may have generated. But those are the two brothers, Rabbi Elimelech and Rabbi Zusha. Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk grave was a great pilgrimage place for Jews from all over Eastern and Central Europe until World War II. I'm not sure if it's still up. Again, Lizhensk is in Poland. I don't know what the mother. I think Leszko is the Polish name for it. But you know that recently, just over the past 20 years, there's been a lot of attempts to renovate and repair some of the grave sites, particularly the great rabbis in Poland. But Rabbi Elimelech's kever was something that was certainly revered by Polish Jews for 150 years. They would go there to pray, etc. Okay. As they say, he was called the second Baal Shem Tov. Okay, so these are two of the disciples of the Maggid. There's Maggid of 300 disciples. I'm not going to go over all of them, but just some personalities I want you to be aware of. The second personality is someone who was also probably one of the most beloved figures of Hasidus, and this was Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. So remember, he was a colleague of Rebbe Elimelech. Rebbe Elimelech was a little older, and in fact, Rebbe Elimelech was considered. Rebbe Elimelech survived the Maggid, the Mezrich Maggid, by 13 years. And for those 13 years, Rebbe Elimelech was considered to be the first among equals. He was the Rebbe of the Rebbes, so to speak. But still, Rebbe Levi Yitzchak, just a few points about him. He was born, of course he had to be, he was born in a family that was a Mignagate, because there was no Hasidic movement when he was born, basically. But in fact, not even when this new sect began to spread town to town, Rav Levi Yitzchak's parents and his in-laws, when he got married as a young man, were very much against his involvement. He was a Talmudic scholar, and this should be emphasized, because we know so much about the gentle, kind nature of the Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, that sometimes we tend not to remember him as a great traditional Talmudic scholar as well, but he was. Again, some of the Hasidic leaders were not known for their scholarship. He, in fact, was. He, in fact, was a very, very eminent Talmudic scholar. In fact, at 1771, when he was only 31 years old, a young man, he became the rabbi of Pinsk. Now, Pinsk was one of the great Jewish communities in Russia. So for a 31-year-old man to become the chief rabbi of such a major community was quite an unusual accomplishment. Several years later, however, because of the various bans against the Hasidic group, which I'll talk about later, he was forced out of town. He was basically run out of town and almost tarred and feathered. He was fired because of his leanings to the Hasidic movement. He was deposed. We do have a record that in 1774, 2 years before the American Revolution, he participated in a public debate in Lithuania, trying to defend the Hasidic movement from various attacks. So he was considered to be erudite enough to be a spokesperson in some type of public debate. He came to Berdichev, which is in Ukraine. Ukraine was always the most favorable area for Hasidus, because they didn't have a strong either rabbinical or Talmudical background. And in Berdichev, he remained for the last 25 years of his life. And that's what he's known to us today as Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. The stories about the Berdichever are legion. And of course, the one outstanding characteristic for which he is known as the defender of Israel, the lover of Israel. In Yiddish, he's called the merciful one. because the term is also used for God. In fact, he was so admired by his contemporaries that one of his contemporaries, a great rebbe in his own right, said that he thanks God every day that God sent this soul down to earth. That is something that he really feels gratitude to God, that there was such a human being who once existed. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liavi, the first Lubavitcher rebbe, said on Rav Levi Yitzchak that there is mercy in heaven that is God, and there is mercy on earth that is Levi Yitzchak. We compare them really to the mercy of God on that particular level. We can talk about, you know, so many stories, maybe hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories, and in fact there is a biography. There aren't too many full-length biographies of Hasidic rebbes, but there is a full-length biography of Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, written by Samuel Dresner, very well-known conservative rabbi. Actually, the truth is, he wrote two books on Hasidus. This is interesting. One book is called Tzadik, which is actually a biography of Rav Eli Melech. So you can go back and read it there. And the other is, I think it's just called The Life of a Hasidic Master, which is a biography of Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Both of them are very well-written. Very clear, and I think it'd be worthwhile reading if you're interested in this. Again, I'll just give you a few stories. Some of these are very, very famous. We have the story that he once saw a Jew eating on the ninth day of Av, and he goes over to the Jew and says, "Why are you eating? You don't know today is Tisha B'Av." And the Jew says, "Yes, you know you're not allowed to eat." He says, "Yes, so what you're doing is open sin." So the Rishon Rebbe turned to God and say, "You see how honest your Jews are, that even when the rabbi of the town asks them, why are they eating in Tisha B'Av, they don't lie." He says, "How can you not have mercy on people who are so honest?" Another time, he saw a person who was wearing his talit and tefillin, was greasing the wheels of his carriage, very disrespectfully. "You take off your talit." And he says, "You see, God, that your people love you so much that they can't disattach themselves, even when they're wheeling their chariot." He once overheard a thief who was boasting about his exploits to his fellow thieves, and the dictionary also said to God, "You see, God, it's a long way until Rosh Hashanah, and they're already confessing his sins." He once said that his goal in life was to love a good Jew a fraction of the amount that God even loves an evil Jew. Meaning to say, God's love was so great that the love that we can have for the best, finest person is only a fraction of the love that God has for even the, what you might call, the least or the lowest person. He says that was his goal. They tell a story that he once went over to the town center, as it were, and said, you know, there's a statement in the Gemara that says, when one does repentance out of love, even the sins turn into mitzvot, which is a concept we can talk about. The sin turns into the mitzvot. So the Berdichever told the Rasha, "What a good deal you have. If you do tshuva, you'll be ahead of me in 1 second because you have so many sins. And, you know, a little conversion will turn all to mitzvot." The story goes that the only time he got angry was at an itinerant maggid, an itinerant preacher, and the preacher would often give very strong words. In other words, one of the jobs of a preacher would be to point out the failings of the people. And he said, "How can a human being, how can one Jew concentrate, it's similar to Rabbi Elimelech's teaching, how can one Jew concentrate on pointing out other people's flaws?" And then he said, "But you know, I know why you do this, because you have to make a living. So my bracha to you is," he says, "my blessing to you is, that God should enable you to make a living without having to point out people's shortcomings. And I'll pray for you that you should have a parnassah where you don't have to do that." And of course, during the high holidays in particular, I have all sorts of stories. He was one of the great figures. He used to argue with God all the time and kind of say, "You know, God, maybe I haven't been that good, but you know, the Jews have been downtrodden and oppressed and everything else. So why don't we call it a deal? I'll forgive you, you forgive me, and we can make a new start right from now." Or he would make you have another argument to God. This is all recorded in his book, that, you know, God, the angels judge us up there. But there's a law in the Gemara that says that a judge who is childless cannot preside over a capital crime, because since he doesn't have small children, he doesn't have the feelings of mercy. So he says, God, the angels don't have kids. You have to disqualify them. You can't allow them to judge. Another story they tell is a story that's before Kol Nidre by Yom Kippur night. He was about to begin Kol Nidre, right? That solemn moment of the year. And all of a sudden he calls over Yankala and he says, Yankala, how much did the parrots were the Polish or the Russian landowners, how much did the parrots pay for that dog that he bought the other day? Because Yankala worked for the parrots. And Yankala said, 1,000 rubles. He says, okay, now I can begin Kol Nidre. So he begins Kol Nidre, etc. And they ask him afterwards, why is it so important that you heard how much the parrots pay for his dog? He says, I'll tell you why. Because remember that this year we had an orphan that needed to be married off. And the Jews did not come up with the money, but the parrots contributed 200 rubles. And in heaven, there's a big prosecution against the Jewish people. How come this parrots gave 200 rubles and the Jewish community couldn't do it? I mean, worse than the parrots. So I wanted to show, or what Yitzhak said, that the parrot didn't care about the Jew, that the parrot spent 5 times as much just on his dog. So just because money is worthless. If money is worthless, then he gives it away. In other words, God shouldn't think it was because of kindness and compassion. That type of thing. We do have, if any of you come from Eastern European homes, who have Yiddish-speaking observant parents, there is a prayer that was recited by generations of Polish, Lithuanian, Hungarian women after Shabbat is over, of God ben Abraham, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, bless this week and give my children health. It's a beautiful Yiddish prayer. He is actually the author of that beautiful Yiddish prayer. In some Siddurim, and you may actually have it in the translation, right? Again, I'll try to bring it in. I think the art school Siddur, the God ben Abraham, it's of Yaakov, is actually translated into English. He was the author. There's another beautiful prayer that in which he is, in fact, this has been set to music, there's even a niggun for this, in which he stands before God and says that, you know, the Babylonians say that they have a king, and the Russians say they have a king, and the Jews have a king, but I, Lady Yitzhak, the son of Sasha, declare that you are my only king, and I'll say he's good at kind of talking to God. And he was a person who was not just a lover of people, but a very God-intoxicated person. A very, very great scholar, but someone who really became a legend in his own time. Another time before shofar blowing, he's about to blow the shofar, and he stops and he says, you know, God, if you don't listen to my shofar blowing, why don't you have Ivan here? Ivan outside blow the shofar. What are you bothering me? And then he reconsiders and says, but you know, God, I love you so much, I have to do it anymore. Even if it doesn't make a difference that he blows the shofar. Another story, again, there's so many stories about the Levi Yitzchak, particularly about Yom Narayim, is that he once said that, you know, before we blow the shofar at the end of Musaf, we make a blessing that God hears our shofar blowing with mercy and compassion. Shomea kol truat amo Yisrael v'lachami. He says, why do we say that? How do we know? So he gave the mashal of a child who wanted a snack. And the parents said, no snacks before dinner. So if the child is smart, they'll just make a bracha. Then the parents have, in other words, right before you eat chocolate, you say, bracha tashem, give up one, shakom we have it below. Now the parents can't refuse to give them the food, because then it will be a blessing in vain. Once you recite a bracha, we have to get. So if we make a bracha, God has listened to our shofar sound, Barach Amin. So God is not going to let there be a blessing in vain. God has to do it. Another teaching story. Now this is a story that I've seen in various versions. It's very hard sometimes to pinpoint. This is a story that's told both about the Baal Shem Tov and the Berditchever. So it's sometimes hard to know because all of these figures tend to be collapsed, but I believe it's about the Berditchever's, the most sources, where he had a person who blew the shofar for him every year, on Rosh Hashanah, and this person wanted to study all of the Kabbalistic Kabbanot. Kabbanot means the specific things that you think about. Again, the intricate system of Kabbalah ascribes a distinct and unique meaning to every single one of the 100 sounds of the shofar. I mean, imagine this. If you looked at the Ari's writings, you would see, for example, that for the first Tekiyah, there are like four pages of things you think about. And then the Shvarim, another four pages of things. Each one, not only that, but of the three Shvarim, each one of them have a distinct Kavanah. I mean, imagine what this would be. In other words, the way the Ari describes the meaning of shofar blowing, you're talking about, you know, 350 pages. And not only that, but, you know, it would be hard to understand even two lines of it anyway. 350 pages of basically incomprehensible material to a large degree. And how do you keep that, and let's say you've learned through it, let's say you understand it, but how do you keep it in mind as you grow into your life? So this person was a big tzaddik, and he studied, and he finally he reduced it to a single sheet of paper, which would kind of prod him as he would be blowing. And lo and behold, the day of the shofar blowing arrived, and he lost the piece of paper. And the way it happens sometimes, like, his mind was blank. He wouldn't remember a thing. I'm sure this happens to all of us. Suddenly he blew the shofar like everyone else blows the shofar. He did it technically correct, but he was very depressed because all of his work didn't work, and he was no better than anybody who blows the shofar. There was nothing special. So Rav Levi Yitzchak asked him afterwards, "Gee, what happened this year that your shofar blowing was so special and so effective and did so many wonders for the Jewish people?" So he says, "Well, I thought it was the opposite. I had studied all this and I had lost it. My heart was broken." So he says the following. He says, "What is Kavanot? In heaven, there are many, many chambers, right? There's the chamber of health, there's the chamber of this blessing and that blessing. And Kavanot are keys that unlock specific chambers, right? The way the Ari works, that mechanistic conception is certain Kavanot will elicit this response, certain Kavanot elicits this response. So Kavanot are important because they are the keys that unlock specific doors. But what does a person do if he lost all his keys and he has to get into the house? You have to take an axe and break the door. Now an axe is better than a key because a key can only open one lock, but an axe can break all locks. And what is the axe? The axe is the broken heart of the person who approaches God in sincerity. So he said, you lost the keys, but you gained the axe. Therefore, you could break down all the doors." This is what he said. And that's the story, that the broken heart of the person who comes to God with sincerity is what God values above all. There's a story about the Baal Shem Tov, the Radicchur. The Radicchur was not a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. The Radicchur is a third generation. But the legend, though, this might be a legend, that the hour the Radicchur was born, he was born, the Baal Shem Tov was still alive, the Baal Shem Tov was celebrated because he had a sense of a great soul has come into the world. He served his students cake and schnapps, as it were. And he said, "But you know, this soul had a hard time coming into the world. Why was this? Because the Satan went to God and said, this soul can turn the whole world around and make them good people. He says, you're not going to leave me anything to do in this world. It's not fair." So the Baal Shem Tov said, I think it's an illustration of Baal Shem Tov's sharp humor. Baal Shem Tov said, "But God said to the Satan, don't worry about it. I'll make him a rabbi. And he will have so many machlokas, so many attacks on him, he won't have time to do all that he's able to do." So, you know, that will limit his input. another teaching of the Radicchur is, again, based on the Talmud. You know, the Talmud says that just like B'nai Yisrael, just like the Jewish people have tefillin, God has tefillin as well. And in our tefillin, we have the Shema, the parshios, the paragraphs of the Shema that talk about the unity of God. In God's tefillin, he has biblical verses that talk about the greatness of Israel. So one of the Radicchur prayers was, you know, God, if we drop your tefillin on the ground accidentally, we kiss them, we take care of them, we put them in a safe place, we try to be sure this never happens again. But your tefillin, that are the Jewish people, have been downtrodden and trampled and dirty for so many thousands of years. Why don't you pick up your tefillin just as we would pick up our tefillin? Okay, final thing again. He used to say the head has three parts. Right, you have the eyes, the ears, and the mouth. Those are the three parts. He says, the eyes are to see godliness, the ears are to hear Torah, and the mouth is to be an advocate for the Jewish people, and not to see, not to be critical of them, and not to put them, give them down. It is also recorded that he said there are three things you can learn from children. He said that when you fall, you get up again. When you hurt, you cry. And you always keep yourself busy. You know, the concept is when you fall, you don't give up hope, right? The baby gets up again. You cry to God, you don't remove yourself from prayer, and you always find something to do. You don't be bored. Of course, 20th century kids do get bored, but boredom is a new invention. If you go back 100 years ago, before there was TV or computers and everything, there really was not that much of a phenomenon of boredom. But today, unfortunately, people do get bored because we're conditioned to have more instant gratification. So this was the famous Berdichever, the one, as they say, that his own colleagues said upon him that every day they thank God that God sent to the world such a wonderful soul. Again, like Rav Elimelech, the Lady Yitzchak was not the founder of a dynasty. It's almost as if he was one of a kind, and they broke the mold after him. He did not have successors, so to speak. But he belongs to the Hasidic movements as a whole. His book is also a classic of Hasidus, and it's called Kedushat Levi, which means the holiness of Levi. His name is Levi. And again, as most Hasidic books, it is organized as homilies on the Parsha of the week. But the appendix is actually very interesting. The appendix has many of these famous stories. There's the publisher of the book. Put in all the different stories and legends that are known about the Berdichever Rebbe. Just to give you an example, though, of what a good, spirited person he was, you know, he lost his very prominent rabbinic position because of the opposition against Hasidus. And as you will see shortly, the main opponent of the Hasidic movement was none other than the phenomenally great and acclaimed Gaon of Vilna. So the Vilna Gaon was really a relentless pursuer against the Hasidic movement. And we'll discuss that shortly. And the Berdichever, so when the Vilna Gaon died, one might have expected the Berdichever not necessarily to be grieved. Perhaps he wouldn't rejoice. That wouldn't be appropriate, but you know, it wouldn't bother him that much. And yet he was deeply grieved. And he said about the Vilna Gaon that the Vilna Gaon was a perfect righteous man. The only Aveira he ever committed in his life was he refused to listen to a Hasidic discourse. That was a sin. But he said that was the only sin he ever committed. And the Berdichever said, again, this might be somewhat fanciful, but this is what he said. He said that when the Vilna Gaon went up to heaven, he was told by the angels in heaven that his life is perfect except for the one sin of not listening to a Hasidic discourse. So he was given a choice. A half an hour in hell, or a half an hour listening to a Hasidic rabbi. The Berdichever says, the Vilna Gaon chose the hell. And as he was being led to hell, all of the millions of pages of Torah that he learned in his life formed a solid wall of paper, and therefore not allowing him to pass the hell. So God had to put him back in heaven. So the Berdichever said, so you see, he got into heaven and he still never heard. I think this says more about the Berdichever than it says about the Vilna Gaon. Meaning, whether this was true, the Vilna Gaon, we have no way of knowing. I don't even think the Berdichever was saying it as any type of prophecy. But I think it says volumes about here is a person who really was quite persecuted by the Gaon of Vilna. We'll discuss the merits of that controversy shortly. And yet we still see that he regarded even him, even his adversary, with respect, admiration. He saw the good qualities, the immense learning, the immense scholarship, and he recognized that such a person could only be rewarded by God at the highest level. So it says very much about what type of person the Berdichever Rav was.
Was it a typical throughout Jewish tradition that arguing with God or complaining to God, telling God you should do a better job, I mean, that was just
well,
personal prayer?
Yeah.
Or is this something new?
Well, let's put it this way. Of course, we do have the biblical antecedents. The first instance of real argument with God is Abraham, where Abraham argues with God. Job engages in various arguments with God, although at the end he seems to just say, I'm not going to argue anymore. But then it becomes dormant for a while. Meaning to say, in the Talmudic and Midrashic tradition.
With Moshe.
Moshe with the sin of the golden calf. Right. Yeah. But even so, it's a little different. I mean, Moshe prays to God, as it were. God wants prayer. Yeah, well, Moshe says, if you don't answer my prayer, erase me from your books, right? You have that argument. So in the Bible, you have a number of examples. But it kind of got renewed in the Hasidic movement, this notion of kind of being engaged with God. That's the concept of engagement, meaning, in fact, there's another song of the Vidichever, which is also set to music. I don't have the tune. It's called the Dudala. Dudala means only you, meaning say, wherever I am, it is only you that I want. You, only you, nothing else but you, etc. And this was, so the concept is that he said, I will argue with God, or I will accept God, but I will always be engaged with God. And he refused, as it were, to ever give up that engagement. The story goes, he died on Sukkot, and he actually said, after Yom Kippur, the last Yom Kippur of his life, that really he should have died right after Yom Kippur, but God knows how much he needs to do to his spouse, new love, one more time. Therefore, God granted him these loving kindness. They already had one more opportunity to take them. And so, and of course, it's reported that he was so, you don't take a lulav and an etrog till the morning of Sukkot. But he was so eager to do this mitzvah, he would stay up all night holding the lulav and the etrog. So the second it becomes dawn, he could recite the bracha. And so that was reported as a... And I would speculate that. Why, indeed, does he love the lulav and the etrog so much? I connected perhaps to the famous Midrash that said the lulav and the etrog represents all the different types of Jews, right? That the etrog, which has the pleasant fragrance and the pleasant taste, represents those Jews who are great in the Torah and in good deeds. The lulav that has the date palm, that has fruits with no fragrance, as the Torah without the ma'asim tovim. The myrtle, which has fragrance and not fruit, is ma'asim tovim without Torah. And the lowly arava, the willow, has no taste and no fruits. And that's the Jew that has nothing. And the message of Sukkot is you must take them all together. And since that really was the motif of his life, one could see why this mitzvah in particular had a special attraction to him. Because this symbolized what he was living for his entire life. Of course, he also loved the mitzvah of Sukkah. But we understand that it's in about Sukkah, that he loves the Sukkah because it is the one mitzvah that he can do even with the mud on his boots. And he said that had a thing because the total, in other words, no matter what you are, you're in the Sukkah, and therefore God accepts the total person. That's what he saw as Sukkah.
Where was writing compiled?
Well, Kedushat Levi is a well-known Hasidic book. Once again, it has not been totally translated. In Dresner's biography, you have excerpts of it that are translated. And then again, if you look at any anthology of Hasidic literature, for example, Lewis Newman has Hasidic anthology, Aryeh Kaplan has something called The Lights Beyond. There are some other anthologies. There's a book called The Great Hasidic Masters by Abraham Finkel. That's a third anthology. So you'll see snippets. But unfortunately, we don't have comprehensive translations of a lot of these works. The truth is, a Hasidic work does not necessarily fare well in translation. Stories can be translated, because the stories give you vignettes, but some of the biblical interpretations are hard to translate, because so much of them are puns, word plays, things that in English, you translate a word in English, but that loses the pun. The puns are not translatable, by and large. So some of the Hasidic exegesis is difficult to, certainly with Kabbalistic is the same thing, it's very difficult to convey in English language. That's why Hasidic stories translate better than actual Hasidic literature.
Excuse me, the original books were written in Hebrew?
Oh, they're written in Hebrew, yeah, they're written in Hebrew, which is interesting, you might say, because some of the common folk, as it were, may not be able to understand. But again, I want to emphasize that the Bradyshikar was a little paradoxical in this sense, because he was a very, very erudite scholar. You wouldn't get that sense from these stories about him. He was the person who really combined both aspects. Oh yes, one other famous thought that he once said, he talked about the fact that the Torah calls the Passover festival Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of Matzah, but we call the festival Chag HaPesach. Why is that? So he said the following. Pesach, which means Passover, is what God did for us. So we call the holiday in a way that we can give thanks to God. Matzot is what we did for God. We baked the matzot. So he says that God refers to the holiday by praising the Jew, and we refer to the holiday by praising God. That's the reciprocal, our relationship. So Moshe maybe as many. So again, this book was also elevated to the status of almost a good luck talisman, meaning Noam Elimelech and Kedushat Levi were books that, you know, if a woman was in labor, you put it under the pillow. It was kind of a good luck charm just to have in the house. And in fact, there was a tradition among Hasidim that every Motzei Shabbat, you know, every Saturday night, they would get together and make a party in honor of the departing Shabbat, and they would say it was good to tell a story of Rav Levi Yitzchak, because in the coming week, we want God to look down at the Jewish people favorably, so we should invoke the memory of this Tzaddik who cared about the Jewish people. So those are there's one more disciple which I'll say for another week, because he needs a whole session for himself. So we mentioned Rav Elimelech of Zusha, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, and the fourth disciple that one should be aware of is the youngest of the group. That is Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who was the great, great theoretician of Hasidus. And that was the author of the Tanya and the founder of the Bava Tree dynasty. Again, Rav Shneur Zalman, in a sense, we do him injustice if we just define him as the founder of a dynasty, as major as that dynasty is. Because in addition to being a founder of a dynasty, the Bava Tree, so to speak, Rav Shneur Zalman is probably the greatest theoretician of Hasidic philosophy. He came from Lithuania. Lithuania, as you know, had a very, very rigorous, in fact, he came from the same place that Olegon came, basically. And he was a very, very great Talmudic scholar and thinker and philosopher. And his books, Tanya and the Kutei Torah, and many other books that he wrote, are really very much classic. So he was not only, so although he perhaps did not become a folk hero of the magnitude of Levi Yitzchak, he was a very, very profound thinker. And really, all of the Hasidic movements that were into the philosophy of Hasidus all drew on Rav Shneur Zalman. We'll save him for another session. But it's interesting to just realize that all of these people were by the Maggid at the same time, although their years overlap. The Levi Melech, Rav Zusha, Rav Levi Yitzchak, Rav Shneur Zalman. In fact, Rav Shneur Zalman's best friend was Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. I mean, they were very, very close friends. Say again? Nachman of Breslov is in Nuskin. Nachman of Breslov, which we'll get to, was the Baal Shem Tov's great-grandson. Mm-hmm. So certainly he was in line, and he lived during his time.
Same generation, though.
Yes, but he did not learn in the Maggid cycle. He was a free spirit who kind of was on his own. And we'll talk about him. In fact, the Nachman of Breslov, a very, very deeply spiritual person, was also a person of many, many different moods. And he did not get along, rightly or wrongly, he did not get along with most of his contemporaries. He said, if I wanted to get along, I would do it. But he said, I don't see any reason to. Because he felt he had a certain group. We'll talk about it now. Rebecca was very fascinating, but he was not part of the Maggid of Mezirich's circle. He was really almost an independent. In fact, he's the only Hasidic Rebbe, really, who was totally independent of that particular sphere of influence. It's like he's directly from the Baal Shem Tov, and he bypassed all of the intermediate levels. Let me go on now to something that's a bit more unpleasant. But if you know the basic personalities, we can now discuss some of the violent reactions against the growth of the Hasidic movement. Now this is at the very end. This is the very end of the 18th century. Now, remember the Hasidic movement gets spread by Rebbe Elimelech, Rav Zusha, with Levi Yitzchak, etc. And it's growing. And generally speaking, I mean, what would happen basically is, how does the movement spread like this? I mean, we actually have eyewitness accounts of some itinerant rabbi would come in, and we start talking in the town square to the blacksmiths and to the farmers and to the shoemakers and saying, have you ever felt close to God before? Do you cry when you pray? You know, is your Judaism superficial? In other words, and people would come and listen, and the speaker would say, why don't you come to this synagogue on Shabbat, and you'll see what prayer is the first time in your life. And people would come, curiosity seekers, some of them, not everybody who showed up became a chassid, but it actually grew through that kind of word of mouth type of situation. Well, what was going on is that as the Hasidic movement was growing, albeit in small ways, there began to be more and more concern that there's some breakaway movements going on here. In fact, the early name for the Hasidic movements, they were called the Kat. Kat means the sect. The sect. Kat.
Okay.
Or they would be called the Karliners. Karlin is simply a city in Lithuania, but apparently the first major growth of Hasidim took place in Karlin. In fact, the word Hasidim was not popularly used until later, but it was interesting. Hasidim, the pious ones, was a term given to them by their opponents as a term of derision. Like Hasidim, pious ones, in quotation marks. And the Baal HaTanya, Shneur Zalman, once remarked that in reality, the Hasidim should have been called the Mitnagdim. Mitnagdim means opponents, because they were opposing the standard techniques. But he says it was God's divine providence that the Hasidim got the good title, that they were called the pious one, and that title was given to them by their enemies, as it were. Be this at night, I'm just getting away. In 1772, a ban of excommunication was pronounced on this entire Hasidic movement. And this was renewed in Vilna and in Brody, mainly in Lithuania, and Grodno. This is Lithuania. And the ban was primarily, it was the elders of Vilna and these other cities, but the main force behind the ban was none other than the Vilna Gaon. Now, in order to understand this, let me talk about the Vilna Gaon. First of all, there's a whole book on this you might find interesting. It's called The Hasidic Movements and the Gaon of Vilna. Very, very well written, fascinating book Elijah as his name suggests, is actually an 11th generation descendant from the Vilna Gaon. I think he's a little rough on the Hasidic movement, but nevertheless, it's a very, very excellent book. Let me say a few words about the Vilna Gaon, first of all, because you have to know who this figure is to understand what is going on. The Vilna Gaon was born in Vilna, 1720. Right, so 20 years after the Baal Shem Tov, so their lives overlapped a little bit, or a lot, the first day of Pesach. The Vilna Gaon was known as a phenomenal prodigy from the time he was a young boy. When he was 6 years old, he gave a massive, complicated discourse on a Talmudic subject in front of the main shul in Vilna, which was a city of scholars. Vilna, Vilnius, was known as the Jerusalem of Lithuania. By the way, just to give you an idea of how high the scholarship was in Vilna, his sons write about their father, that when our father gave his original Talmudic discourse at the age of 6, people were not impressed because they said his father taught him what to say. Now, think about that today. You know, if I had a 6-year-old who could give a complicated Talmudic discourse just because I taught him, that's pretty impressive too. The point was, people were not impressed with that. They said, no, this was our father's own creation at the age of 6. By the time he was in his 20s, he had mastered the entire, not only Babylonian Talmud, but the Jerusalem Talmud, all the Midrashim, the Bible, all the Kabbalah. He was a great Kabbalist. He was a great mystic. He claimed to have various visions as well, of Elijah the prophet and the like.
He was a Kabbalist?
He was a great Kabbalist. great Kabbalist. That's absolutely the case. In fact, he wrote much more in Kabbalah than he wrote in Halakha. He was a great, great, he was not a chassid, of course, but he was a great Kabbalist. In his 20s, he also decided to go into exile. He wandered around for 8 years. This was an old custom, the Hasidim and non-Hasidim did it. It was a way of acquiring humility and kind of, and he wandered around incognito. And we have various stories. He was thrown in prison for loitering once, various times, etc. Story goes, according to the accounts, when he got back to Vilna, he adopted a regimen where he would study Torah 22 hours a day out of 24 hours.
Wow.
He only slept 2 hours a day in 4 increments of a half an hour each. He would never sleep for more than half an hour at a time. He only ate, 2 pieces of bread a day. Basically, he was totally involved in the study of Torah. In his later years, he began to teach students. But for much of his life, he was a recluse. And the community of Vilna recognized that he was such a special person, and they supported him. His sons reported that for a number of years, his stipend given by the Vilna community was actually misappropriated by one of the messengers, and he never complained. He did not want to embarrass somebody and the like. And there are many, many stories about his diligence. Occasionally when he would travel, and he didn't travel that much, but given he would travel and he would be lodging somewhere, people would stand on ladders just to watch him study through the night. And the story once goes that once he was in a hotel somewhere in some city where people were peering in the windows to try to get to see him, and when he went to sleep for his 10 minutes, he inadvertently slept for 20 minutes. And when he got up, he started crying and bemoaning his fate that he's lost 10 minutes and how he could never be in this city again because they took 10 minutes of his time from him. But then, somehow, 10 years later, he was there again, and he made it his business to skip one of his 10-minute naps. And the city rejoiced in his recording because we gave him back the time. The person was really, I don't want to say obsessed. A person who basically penetrated the entire Torah. Basically, there was nothing in the Torah that he didn't know, that he didn't understand, that he couldn't explain, that he couldn't correct. He is considered to be, by the way, the founder of the scientific study of Talmud as well, because he even compared manuscripts to give us the appropriate text. He has glosses about the texts for all the Midrashim which were corrupted and the Jerusalem Talmud which wasn't studied, etc. And he felt that all halakhic decisions have to go back to the Talmud. He derived everything from the Talmud. His great student, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, which we'll talk about, once remarked about his teacher, that his teacher knew the Talmud, knew the whole Torah, the way a Jew who davens 3 times a day, better than a person knows Ashrei. Ashrei is a common prayer that's read 3 times a day. But he says, my Rebbe knew the Torah better than that. Because most people who daven 3 times a day can say Ashrei forward, but you couldn't say it backwards or sideways or the like, because he knew everything so thoroughly that anything could be said forward, backwards. Somebody came to him and said, he used to advise his students that each student should memorize a tractate of the Talmud so that when they're traveling, they'll have something to study. So somebody went to him and said, I have memorized the tractate dealing with Sukkah, dealing with the laws of Sukkah. So he says, test me. So the Vilna Gaon said, okay, I'll test you. How many times does the word Sukkah appear in the whole tractate? How many times is Rabbi so-and-so mentioned? Today we can do this with computers, okay? But he did this without computers. He doesn't know it. There was nothing that he didn't know. It is said that people would go to him and they would ask him questions. Academics would ask him questions in mathematics, astronomy, biology, science. He had mastered everything. According to the legend, he only looked at secular studies in the bathroom when one is not allowed to study Torah. But be it as it may, he is actually a person who is known not only for his phenomenal knowledge of Torah, but for his phenomenal knowledge of really wisdom, particularly mathematics. And in fact, he commissioned one of his students to make a Hebrew translation of Euclid's Principles of Geometry. Many Jews did not read Greek or Latin, and he felt that they should master geometry. And he said, in fact, Norman Lamb uses this a lot for his brief in favor of secular studies, that if a Jew does not understand secular wisdom, he will not understand the Torah either, because the Torah is based on incorporating all of that wisdom. The story goes that somebody went to him and asked him a question. Somebody was a non-traditional Jew, was attacking the divine origin of the Bible and the like, and went through a bunch of questions. And he asked the Vilna Gaon a question, and the Vilna Gaon said, "Well, is that your only question?" He said, "No, I have more." So he says, "Okay, ask your other question." So anyway, the person asked him 75 questions in a row. And after the person asked him 75 questions in a row, the Vilna Gaon said, "Your 75 questions are really 15 questions, because question 1, 17, 24, are based on the same common misconception. And then question 14, 25, you know," he says, "so really, your 73 questions boil down into 5 groups, and these are the 5 answers to your questions." You know, like someone who just came in information. So he was a phenomenal genius, number one, a person of great phenomenal diligence, who spent hours and years in seclusion. Again, some of the stories might be a little off-putting to us. The story goes that when his sister visited him, toward the end of his life, and they had not seen each other for 36 years. He said, "Hello, how are you?" That he wanted to go back to continue learning. And his sister says, "Can't you spend another 15 minutes with me?" And he basically said, you know, he pointed to his gray beard and said, "There'll be plenty of time, you know, after you're dead to spend time together." And I would say he had to study. So, as you would expect, the Vilna Gaon, and by the way, interestingly enough, this is very paradoxical, what he was known as, Gaon is a term that means not so much genius, being excellent, one who has excelled, as a title of nobility for one who was great in Torah, but he was also called, paradoxically, HaGaon HaChassid, which is ironic. He was not the Baal Shem Tov's Chassid, but he was known as the pious one, because he was very, very separate. He ate very little, he slept very little. He was not involved in politics in any particular degree. His life was one of learning. At one point he made Aliyah, he wanted to go to the land of Israel, but he never completed the trip, and it's still a source of mystery why he did not complete the trip. There are references, veiled references to Min HaShamayim, from heaven, they did not allow me to go, etc. He was a great Kabbalist, and there's some indication that he thought that if he would come to Israel, he could hasten the coming of the Mashiach. He didn't go, but it's interesting that from the time he returned, he did switch his orientation from his own learning to then becoming a great teacher. One can speculate that originally perhaps he thought he could bring the Messiah on his own, then he realized he would have to share his learning with others. Now, I understand that from the 20th century perspective, from our more modern perspective, we look at this and we see this as somewhat extreme. But you have to, again, I don't know if I'm conveying this properly, you have to remember that the Vilna Gaon had an enormous influence on the culture, the Jewish culture of Lithuania. He established the primacy of Torah. He established the fact that the highest way of serving God was to delve into the details of the Torah. Also, although he himself was not actively involved in the community that much, but his disciples, he was someone like the Maggid of Mezerich, his disciples were the founders of the great yeshivot that populated Eastern Europe in the 19th and 20th century, up until the destruction of World War II, and the great yeshivot that exists today, the great rabbinical colleges that exist today, are really the outgrowths of the work of the Vilna Gaon. So he was a pivotal figure that had a tremendous impact on learning, and again, in many directions, in the development of the yeshivot that produced the commitment to Torah study, on the development of scientific approaches to Judaism that examines texts and history and context, and finally, even on the integrations, you could use the Vilna Gaon for a lot of things, even on the integration of secular culture in Judaism. Although he was not a secularist by any stretch of the imagination, he did advocate the concept of combining secular understanding with Judaism.
So he was a very, very pivotal person. He was also a person of great personal generosity in terms of sharing the limited resources that he had with others, which accordingly was very, very given, very kindly, and the like. Well, the Hasidic movement disgusted him, to be frank, because he saw the Hasidic movements as an attack on all that he considered to be sacred. He taught that the highest way a human being serves God is through the study of Torah. And here we have a movement that says, it's not, so it was done. Again, one of the major questions is, was the Vilna Gaon fully informed? And who gave the Vilna Gaon his information? Remember, the Vilna Gaon was not interested in going out and conducting service. The Vilna Gaon was in his room, and he only knew what he was told. But what he was told, we'll talk about the agenda of the people who were giving him this information, what he was told is, here you have a movement that doesn't care about the study of Torah, that says studying of Torah is not important. They denigrate Talmudic scholars. They talk about the common man serves God through prayer, etc. And this was something that only someone like the Vilna Gaon, who had such feelings, really a love affair with the Torah, the Vilna Gaon, this was destroying, this was ripping out his heart. And in a very rare intervention, Vilna Gaon was not someone who intervened all the time, but in a very rare intervention, he joined and he promulgated a number of bans and excommunications against the Hasidic movements. This was during the 1770s and the 1780s, and it was kind of a very crazy time. I'll read you the text of some of the bans. We'll see what a ban was in those days. That there was some Hasidic guy that claimed he was the Vilna Gaon's son. And he said, my father recants all this, and the Vilna Gaon had the kind of issue, he is not my son, and I don't recant, or that type of thing.
Did he have family?
Oh, yes, the Vilna Gaon had children, sure, the Vilna Gaon had children, who followed his tradition, by and large. Not to the same level, but they were an esteemed family. One thing that at various points was a very messy time, because some of the less refined Hasidim tried to get the Vilna Gaon in trouble. They filed a complaint with the Vilna government that the Vilna Gaon didn't pay his taxes and he didn't have a job, you know. So the Vilna Gaon had to defend that. You know, there were various things going on. But let me just read you a text of one of the bans so you see what this was. We have a Vilna ban of 1772, a Brody was known in a Lithuanian city, 1772, a 1781 reiteration of the ban, etc. Rudna and Pinsk, remember Pinsk? That's why the religion was kicked out of Pinsk, because of a ban that was promulgated. He lost his job, etc. Here is a ban that was issued in 1786. Right, this has already been 15 years of these fights that were going on. We order that a fast and public prayer be instituted on the 25th of the month of Tevet of the current year. All possible measures are adopted to put an end to the prayer meetings of these heretics in all communities so that they will be deprived of the possibility of common assembly. Careful watch is to be maintained that no one should study their literature, and search of houses is to be made with this purpose in mind. We fully confirm the validity of the ordinances which were issued in Vilna in 1781, which deal with the prohibition of pilgrimages to the heads of this sect. The word kat is a very derogatory term. Kat. What their ritual slaughters kill may not be, they actually proclaimed, any meat that they slaughter is trade. No one is to shelter any member of this sect. No member of this sect will be allowed to bring a lawsuit in a Jewish court. No community may permit any one of them to hold a position as cantor or rabbi. And it goes without saying, no one of them is allowed to teach our children. It is to be announced in all communities that anyone who knows anything, good or bad, about these Hasidim, in quotation marks, must bring his information to this rabbinic court. So they were really characterized as almost criminals. And in fact, there are other bans that say you will not allow them, not allow their wives.
How long did they last?
Only around 20 years.
Did the Vilna Gaon ever recant at
Okay, so well, this is an old story. We'll get into that in a second. Let me just say, though, that some other bands indicate that the wives of those who are affiliated with the Hasidic movement were not allowed to use the ritual bath. They were actually designed to be considered and even recorded that the Vilna Gaon, when he saw the text that he damned to agree with, criticized them as not going far enough, and he said it would have been his desire to treat them like the Eliyahu HaNavi treated the prophets of the Bible. If you remember, in the Book of Kings, Eliyahu HaNavi actually wanted to kill the 400 prophets of the Bible, and he says that is what he wanted. Now, the thing is this.
From our perspective.
Yeah, well, that's why I want you to, that's why I'm off the over. But the point is the following. The point is that the evidence clearly indicates that the information that Vilna Gaon received about the movements went far beyond this. It involved very, very serious allegations of sexual impropriety. It involved drunkenness, nudity, orgies, all sorts of things. Now, this may have been totally false, or there may have been some extremists who joined the movement just to get on drugs or whatever they were doing. Well, I'll give you an example. There is a quote here in some Hasidic literature, which might be pseudo-Hasidic literature, about the importance of sexual stimulation before prayer, because this was a way in which one could turn their animal drives towards the service of God. So there was some indication of cultic masturbation. Now, this was not at all the people we're talking about, Rabbi Elimelech, with Lady Yitzchak. That was not their thing. We know that. Nevertheless, there were corners of people who were lagging or tagging onto this movement. Now remember too that this is the generation right after Shafsai Tzvi. Jacob Frank, the Frankists, who in fact did engage in these practices, were around. The Vilna Gaon sees a movement that has certain participants who resemble that. So what might be regarded as an overreaction has to be understood in terms of these other allegations. And we'll discuss next week that you have these extreme things, which are very, very disturbing, but we're only a minority lunatic fringe. And then you have some other Kabbalistic disagreement that they have, etc. The one who tried to be the great peacemaker was Rav Shneur Zalman, who requested a meeting with the Vilna Gaon a number of times, and the Vilna Gaon refused to see him. Now, among Hasidim, there are various traditions that at the end of the Vilna Gaon's life, he regretted it. But I think that's a ritual thing, more or less. There is no tradition among the Mishnagdim that he regretted it. Hasidim have a certain tradition. So we'll talk about this. Again, I don't want to dwell too much on the negative, but it's an important... I do want to emphasize, though, that this extreme animosity lasted for no longer than 30 to 40 years. After that point, it did subside, and we really don't have that type of situation anymore. We have different fights, not that.
What are the numbers?
Which one?
The numbers,
Number of the people.
Yeah.
Well, at this point, the Hasidic movement is not more than 3 to 4,000. It's not a major movement yet. But it was developing in some major centers, Vilna, Radna, these are big cities, and they wanted to put it on a brush fire before it got into the
streets. So you really have the power to enforce.
Oh yes, keep in mind that Jewish communities had autonomy there. They had rabbinic courts, they had imprisonment powers, they could whip people, and they had all sorts of powers. This is pre-emancipation, so legally the Jewish community had no enforcement powers. Okay, I hope everyone has a good
surprise.
This is a story about a person that we haven't really discussed. We're not going to discuss it that much in this class, but this is probably the only time I'll mention it. But this is Rabbi Yehiel Michal of Zlatshov, the Zlatshov or Magid. A lot of people call the preacher. He was a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, who did not lead a movement and did not found a movement or anything else.
Could you say his name again?
Rabbi Yehiel Michal of Zlatshov. Called the Zlatshover, the Zlatshover Magid, the preacher of Zlatshov. He was also an itinerant preacher. And the story goes that he once married, he managed somehow, I don't know how, to get hold of the Baal Shem Tov's tefillin. When the Baal Shem Tov died, he got the Baal Shem Tov's tefillin, which were a very, very important and wonderful thing. And of course, his family was starving, there was no food in the house, etc. And his family was urging him, why don't you sell the tefillin for a lot of money and you could bring it in and buy food for the family. And he said, no, how can I give up this great mitzvah just for money? Anyway, it came Sukkot. Now you have to know one thing, that Sukkot in Europe, particularly a few hundred years ago, it was not as easy to get a lulav and an etrog as it is in the United States. Now everybody can get it, whatever it costs, $30, $40, but most people can get it. But in Europe, where this had to be imported either from Israel or from Italy, and transportation was difficult and rare, it was very common in many cities for there only to be maybe one etrog that was kosher. It was very, very difficult. And especially if you want an etrog that doesn't have any blemishes, very, very difficult to get. So Rabbi Yehiel Michal is looking around for a lulav and an etrog, and finally he sees that somebody has this beautiful etrog. And he says, I'll pay you whatever, I'll borrow the money, whatever you ask for. He says, no. The only thing I want is the tefillin. So now he has this tremendous dilemma. But he says, there's a mitzvah, and I can't get the etrog any other way. So he sells the tefillin, he gives the tefillin in exchange for the etrog, which of course he only used for 6 days of Sukkot. So anyway, when he gets home, again, this reflects a little negatively on his wife, but one can understand the frustrations. His wife is so furious. She thinks about the years of deprivation, the years of starvation, and now here he comes along and he sells the tefillin just for an etrog, which after 1 week, is not going to be usable anyway. And she takes the etrog, she throws it against the wall, and she breaks the pizza, she breaks the tip, which renders the etrog non-kosher. So one can imagine, he doesn't have his tefillin, he doesn't have his etrog, and he has no money for his family anyway. He has nothing. So the story goes that he lifts up his eyes to Hashem, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to God, and he says, God, you took away my tefillin, and you took away my etrog, and you took away any way I can support my family. But I know that the one thing the Satan wants to take away is my shalom bayit, my relationship with my wife. He says, that's the one thing I'm not going to allow you to take away. And he basically
Shalom.
And the story goes that the Baal Shem Tov came to him in a dream and said that your second action was much more beloved by God than your first. Meaning, on one hand, you sacrificed the tefillin for the etrog, which was a great mitzvah, but the way you wanted to preserve the shalom bayit was a greater mitzvah than yours. That's one little etrog story about the Yehiel Michal of Zlatshov. Now let me tell you an etrog story about the Vilna Gaon. It happened to the Vilna Gaon, which involved a lot of the same scenario, where the Vilna Gaon needed an etrog, and there's only one person in the city that had a good one. And the person said, I will sell you the etrog if you give me all of your share in the world to come for all of the mitzvot that you did. And the Vilna Gaon immediately agreed to it, and the Vilna Gaon said, I'm very grateful because now I can serve God without hope of reward. That's the ultimate way of serving God as well. If you remember, we had an identical story, not about the etrog, about the Mezuritcher Magid.
Right.
It's fascinating that stories, identical stories, are told about people who are on opposite sides of this particular debate. We don't know if both are true or none are true or whatever, but it just shows you that we're dealing with righteous people on all sides of the equation. Anyway, last week we were discussing the controversy between the Hasidic movements and the mitnagdim. Right, the word mitnaged is an opponent, and Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, used to say it was really divine providence that the group that is opposed to Hasidut should be called Mitnadim, because that implies that they're the breakaway, they're the splinter group. I mean, in reality, he said, the Hasidic movement should have been called the Mitnagei, because they were breaking away from a mainstream. Ironically, he said, the very fact that the opponents of Hasidut gave themselves the name Mitnaged, in effect detracted from their legitimacy, because it suggests that they're the breakaway and the Hasidim were the mainstream. So he said that this was Hashgacha. Anyway, we talked briefly about the fact that the Vilna Gaon, who by far was the outstanding Talmudic authority, and indeed he was the role model for Lithuanian Jewry for hundreds of years, and indeed he's still a role model, albeit an unapproachable role model, in terms of the primacy of Torah study, of mastery of the Torah, his total commitment, his total immersion to the exclusion of everything else. The Vilna Gaon was very rarely involved in politics, but this was something that truly incensed him. And there were a lot of reasons. Reason number one was that to the Vilna Gaon, any movement that detracted from the importance of Torah study by emphasizing emotion, by emphasizing alternative paths to God, was ripping the heart out of what the Vilna Gaon considered to be the very foundation of Judaism. That his great, great criticism of the Hasidic movement was it de-emphasized Talmud Torah. Now, is that an accurate characterization or not? One can find quotes within the Hasidic movements on both sides of the issue. There are certainly statements in Rav Yaakov Yosef. Remember, he was the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov who wrote Toldot Yaakov Yosef, and he was very anti-clerical and anti-rabbinic, and he made a number of statements about the rabbis spend too much time over a Gemara, etc., which one could construe in that way. The Mezuritcher Magid, who became the actual leader of Hasidut, was not negative in that sense, but after all, the Magid of Mezuritch didn't publish anything. So consequently, the Vilna Gaon got this information primarily from literary sources. It should be emphasized, though, too, that the Vilna Gaon, who was fairly reclusive, also got a lot of his information from various sources who had in their vested interests a desire to disparage the Hasidic movement. So that's one issue that Vilna Gaon had, that he felt there was a denigration of the primacy of Talmud Torah. Now, from our fairly shallow perspective, a debate whether one should study Torah 18 hours a day or one should study Torah 5 hours a day, you know, hardly seems to be a great moment since most of us do not study Torah even 1 hour a day. But nevertheless, in a society where Talmud Torah was the lifeblood of what it meant to be a Jew, this was a very, very serious point. Point number two that the Vilna Gaon felt was that Hasidut very much emphasized not merely the performance of mitzvot, but they emphasized the emotional state that accompanies a mitzvah, particularly the notion of hitlavut, that is enthusiasm, kavanah, understanding what you're doing, ahava, love of God, yirah, fear of God. And they made the point constantly that doing mitzvot without those proper feelings, in effect, was an empty ceremony that did not accomplish very much. Now remember, too, that the milieu of which they spoke refers to Yichudim. Yichudim are the unification of the masculine and the feminine spirits of God. And there's the whole Kabbalistic apparatus that explained that. But even if you abstract it, because after all, the Vilna Gaon, by the way, subscribed to fundamentally the same Kabbalistic apparatus. So the Kabbalistic apparatus was not the major point of contention, but the Hasidic movement emphasized what is called Pnimiyut HaAvodah. Pnimiyut HaAvodah is the internal dimension of divine service. Now, that's a wonderful thing. There's nobody that could debate the importance of that. But what that sometimes translated into was a denigration of some of the formalities of halakha. In particular, the Vilna Gaon was very incensed that there were stories. There were stories that there were many segments of the Hasidic movement that did not say the prayers during the right times. You know, Shacharit, morning prayer, Mincha, the afternoon prayer, Arvit, the evening prayers, have prescribed times. Just to give you an example, the Shacharit prayer is only supposed to be recited until noon, once you're in the second half of the day. But let's assume I'm a Hasid, and I believe that prayer without Kavanah is worthless. And let's assume I'm not a morning person. So I might say, you know, I'm not inspired yet. I'll wait till 2 in the afternoon when I get inspired.
Well, the Vilna Gaon felt that this was very, very destructive. Now again, it's very important that you remember the Frankist movements and Shabtai Tzvi. In other words, the Vilna Gaon is afraid that once you de-emphasize halakha, you're opening the doors to all sorts of things which could ultimately destroy Judaism. The Vilna Gaon felt Talmud Torah and Shmirat Mitzvot were the foundation. Everything else is beautiful frosting, but you need that foundation. And therefore, he was very much against the concept of the Hasidic movement not fulfilling the halachot with all of their pratim, with all of their detail. Zmanei tefillah, times of prayer was one example, etc. Again, there were other issues as well. One of the innovations of the Hasidic movement, which by the way is now a universal custom, I bet you wouldn't even know it's from the Hasidic movement, is the concept of communal seudah shlishit. You know, in most synagogues, the third Shabbat meal is not eaten at home, but it's eaten in the synagogues. Sometimes just men, sometimes men and women, depending on the synagogue. Now, the concept that on Shabbat you have to have three meals, that was not invented by the Hasidic movement. That is already in the Talmud. But, basically, until the Baal Shem Tov, you have the third meal at home the same way you have the first two meals at home. But the Baal Shem Tov developed the concept that the third meal was a time for fellowship, where his Hasidim would come together, and they would sing songs, and they would tell stories, and they would go late into the night. In fact, sometimes they would go until the morning. Mm-hmm. They would make Havdalah, not Saturday night, they would make Havdalah Sunday morning. They would go. That's a Hasidic invention. That was clearly invented by the Baal Shem Tov, and that is one example of a Hasidic custom that has really become mainstream. I mean, I think most synagogues of the traditional bent, whether Orthodox or conservative, do have a Suda Shlishit in the synagogue of one form or another. But, as you would expect, an innocuous custom like that, what's the big deal, was also found to be offensive. Why are you departing from tradition? Why are you separating men from their families? You know, why are you trying to break up the families? They should go home and have Suda Shlishit. And of course, the fact that they spent so much of it telling stories was also offensive to the Vilna Gaon. They should be learning the Chumash and learning the Talmud instead of telling various stories. Now, because of this, by the way, the Hasidim were very instrumental in the construction of an Eruv. Are you familiar with what an Eruv is? On Shabbat, technically, one is not supposed to carry from inside our building to outside or vice versa. But the way we can fix that up is by kind of using wires to create a symbolic wall. It's called an Eruv. Now, some authorities didn't like the Eruv. They considered it to be an evasion or a legal fiction. But the Hasidim needed to make Eruvs because otherwise they couldn't bring their food to the synagogue for the third meal. So the third meal actually created the institution of many Eruvs in European cities, which the Vilna Gaon felt was halakhically questionable. So that was another issue. You're carrying on Shabbat. So there's a whole bunch of issues like that, but it's not so much the specific. What the Vilna Gaon was afraid of is...
Wasn't Eruv in the Gemara?
Yes, Eruv is in the Gemara. Certainly, Hasidim did not invent Eruv. That's very, very clear. There's a whole tractate in the Talmud about building an Eruv.
Yeah.
But there are many, many conditions that might need to be satisfied. And
so what is specific to Hasidim in Eruv?
Huh?
What is something specific for them?
Well, for example, some people felt that in major cities with large populations, an Eruv would not be appropriate. But the Hasidim constructed them in large cities. Again, this is not a complete innovation. There are different classical opinions, but they followed lenient views because they needed to do what they're doing. So that's. But again, the issue went beyond specific practice. The issue, as the Vilna Gaon saw it, was the substitution of emotion for practice. And he felt that in the long run he needed a standardized practice because emotion could lead a person too far afield. For example, let's assume a person isn't inspired to think about the Exodus until Shavuot. Does that mean I'm not going to make a Seder until Shavuot? Because that's when I'm inspired. The Vilna Gaon felt that there has to be a structure. And theologically, he basically said, mitzvot are not there for your ego gratification. Mitzvot are there to serve God. So whether it turns you on or excites you, the Vilna Gaon says, was fundamentally irrelevant because mitzvot means submission to authority, which he understood as divine authority. That's a second concern that he had with the Hasidic movement. There was a third concern. I really have no information about this, but apparently this was a major issue, not with the Vilna Gaon, but with other people. One of the innovations, you know, we still say today, I don't know if you're familiar with this expression, we have shechita, that's the ritual slaughter of kosher animals. So sometimes you'll see when a resort in the Catskills is advertising their suitability for ultra-Orthodox people, you'll say, chasidah shechita. This is shechita under the rules of the chasidim. Now, the knife in which an animal is slaughtered is supposed to be very sharp with no nicks. If there's any nicks which catch, it's not a kosher shechita. Apparently the Hasidim innovated a new custom of ultra-sharp knives. Why this is so is a bit shrouded in mystery, and why this became an issue of controversy is frankly shrouded in mystery as well, but there were a lot of complaints about the Hasidim acting overly righteous with these extra-sharp knives. Now that was not the Vilna Gaon's concern. The Vilna Gaon didn't care. As long as the knife was sharp, he didn't care if it was extra-sharp. But once again, that became an issue. But in terms of the Vilna Gaon, the two primary issues are the primacy of Talmud Torah and the notion of Shmirat HaMitzvot, even at the expense of Pnimiyot HaAvodah, the internal emotional state.
When you talk about Pnimiyot and Avodah,
yeah.
Avodah, you mean Avodat Hashem or Avodah
Leshem Avodah? No, I mean Avodat Hashem. Avodah is divine service.
Yeah,
Pnimiyot is the internal emotional state.
Because I have a problem with this. In Israel, as you know now, we have a really problem between the branches, what's going on.
Yes.
And one of the really is that the Bachurei Yeshivot that do the Avodat Hashem, and they don't do the Kazer Avodot, or they don't go
okay.
to the army.
That's another issue.
It really became yes. a status and Sin Atachim almost.
That's a difficult issue. I'm not addressing that now.
Okay, but this is Avodat Hashem.
Avodat Hashem, right. Now, other than to say, though, that people should know that there are many religious Orthodox, even Hasidim, who do serve the Lord. There are many who don't, yes, yeah. There are. But there are many who do. It shouldn't be regarded as an all-or-nothing situation. A third concern of the Vilna Gaon was the role of the Tzaddik or the Rebbe. He saw it as problematical. The Vilna Gaon very much, although the Vilna Gaon was a Rebbe of sorts in his own right, as it were, but the Vilna Gaon saw the concept of using the Rebbe as somehow an intermediary between man and God, human being and God, was very close to idolatry. And he felt it was very, very essential that people have their own, feel they have their own connection with God, etc. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon was so strong on this point that he even censored various prayers that made references to the angels. He didn't like the Shalom Aleichem prayer, where you greet angels Friday night during the Shabbat home. You say, welcome angels. He says, why are you talking to angels? You talk to God. In other words, he was very much against the concept of even symbolic intermediaries between a Jewish person and God. And he saw the Rebbe, the Hasidic Rebbe, the concept that the Rebbe will pray for me, the Rebbe will elevate me, the Rebbe will get me into the world to come. He saw that as dangerous. It was bordering on personality cult worship. And he saw it as an abdication of the responsibility of the individual to live his life in accordance with the Torah.
Okay.
Again, was that legitimate criticism? We'll see. We'll get to that. But certainly, remember that the Vilna Gaon was presented a very exaggerated picture by those who were doing the presenting.
How come a person with that stature didn't investigate more and rely on...
Yeah. Okay, then that'll bring me to my next point, and you'll see. Now, another point which he was concerned about, which colored everything else, was the real presence of what I would call a lunatic fringe of Hasidim, who in fact were guilty of very, very serious things, such as a sexual debauchery, the concept of masturbation for the sake of heaven. Again, there was the concept of stimulating sexual passion and giving that over to God, various things like that, which, by the way, historians of mysticism say had a connection to things that were even going on in the Christian church at various times. The concept of, there's a quote, I didn't bring it in, but there's some astounding quote in somebody's Gemara about about seminal emissions for the sake of heaven, where he said that this is the best thing to do, that when you want to feel love for God, imagine a naked woman next to you, and then take that love and say, I give it to God. The Villadon thought this was very, very bizarre. It was evil. Now, this was a lunatic fringe. But the Villadon was afraid that the movement was heading. I'm talking about, this was a lunatic fringe within the Hasidic movements. Well, they didn't have a distinct Rebbe, but they were the followers of Rav Aaron of Karlin. Karliners, they were called, because Karlin was a city in Lithuania. Others were more benign, but still it was somewhat bizarre. There were those who would do somersaults during the Amidah, because they felt that the verse King David says in the Psalms, "Kol atzmotai, all of my limbs," that's the verse of the Psalms, "I praise God," and they felt it was literal. By the way, even the concept of shuckling, as we say in Yiddish, where people move back and forth and sway, was kind of a Hasidic innovation, meaning to say, the norm of prayer, the normal stance of prayer, was to be stationary.
Really?
Now the Hasidim kind of brought in the idea of extreme movements as a way of inducing ecstatic states. Some of them veered into somersaults, but even the normal shuckling. Again, it was not a major criticism of Villadon. The Villadon said, you know, what is this shuckling here? Another concern was divisiveness, because the Hasidic movements very early on established little shuls that were separated from the communal synagogues. Now, of course, they did so because they had these different rituals, etc. But nevertheless, they did so, and these little shuls were called shtiblach. A shtibl means a little house. Even today, a little Hasidic minyan is called a shtibl. They were called a shtiblach. Is that
right?
Well, a little house, but it was used. It was the specific name that was used for the Hasidic breakaway minyanim. And of course, there was also within the fellowship of Hasidim, there was a strong use of alcohol and tobacco. And the Villadon had reports of drunkenness, and like them, they may have been fairly isolated, maybe not. I really don't have the statistics, so to speak. But nevertheless, the Villadon was not a teetotaler, of course. But he said, you know, what do we need? Drunkenness, tobacco, etc. He also felt his problem with the Rebbe was, the concept of the Rebbe was not only the intermediary idea, which is a theological idea, but he also felt that some people were gaining authority within the movement who did not have great Torah knowledge. And that was also something that he felt was not proper. In fact, his great disciple once said a wonderful, very cute remark, the Villadon's disciple. He said, what is the difference between a misnaged leader and a Hasidic leader? He said, it's the difference between a headache and a stomachache. Oh. He says, what's the mashal that he gave? He gave a mashal like this. Let's say you have a child, and the child wakes up and says, I can't go to school today, I have a headache. So what you do is you feel the head, you take the temperature. If the temperature feels good, you send it to school. But if the child wakes up and says, I have stomachache, you have no way to check. You're stuck. So he says, you know, when a mitnagei claims, I'm a rabbi, I'm a leader, we can test that. How much do you know? Do you know this halakha, that halakha? When a Hasidic person establishes charismatic leadership, it's like a stomachache. You got to take him at his word. And he said there was no way of verifying that particular story. So these were some of the concerns the Villadon had. There are other concerns as well, which are actually technical Kabbalistic concerns. And that is, in particular, the Vilna Gaon was very, very critical of the notion that was developed in particular by the Maggid of Mezrimich and some of his disciples of the immanence of God in all things, the fact that everything has the divine spark in it. The Vilna Gaon felt that was close to a pantheistic conception, that all of nature is the same as God, and he insisted that we recognize that God transcends nature rather than being immanent to nature. There are certain Kabbalistic disagreements. Again, these may seem somewhat arcane to us, but rest assured that this was a very, very major concern of the Vilna Gaon. And again, you have to remember, this is the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi. This is a short time after Spinoza, who of course was the pantheist par excellence. Spinoza himself was excommunicated by the Amsterdam Jewish community for pantheistic ideas. So this was a major, major issue at that time. The Vilna Gaon, therefore, we talked about yesterday, instituted a number of excommunications and bans against the Hasidic movements. People were asking me after class about this excommunication. Let me just explain it a little bit, just so you get a sense of what it was. The concept of excommunication, which in Hebrew is called cheren, putting someone in cheren, or nidui is another word for it, is an institution that is certainly recognized in halakha. It is mentioned in the book of Ezra as early as the beginning of the Second Temple. The Mishnah and the Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud discuss the concept very, very extensively. When a person is put in cheirin, in excommunication, basically people are not supposed to. It's kind of the equivalent of shunning, in a way. The Amish have shunning, the Quakers have shunning. It's a very similar process. We don't do business with the person, we don't talk to the person, we stay 4 amot, 8 feet away from the person, etc. Now, it's not supposed to be a lifetime thing. There is, of course, the possibility of tshuva, recanting. In other words, the person can get out of it by agreeing to whatever terms are imposed. This was the notion of cheirin. Now, remember that for most of the Middle Ages, and really up until the French Revolution, Jewish communities had legal autonomy over their citizens. In other words, the government recognized Jewish courts, which could punish offenders and the like. And one of the powers that Jewish communities were given legally by the host government was the power to impose excommunication and bans, if that was so. Now, obviously, the power was sparingly used. It was not used very often, but there were bans that came against the Hasidic movements. But of course, the only people who would listen to the bans were those who were mitnagdim anyway, meaning the Hasidim didn't listen to the ban. They continued to meet together. Now, even today, the institution of cheirin theoretically exists, but it's much less powerful because as there are fewer and fewer Jews who obey traditions, there are fewer and fewer Jews who listen to these things. You go to Jerusalem, for example, and you know, in Jerusalem they have wall posters. If you've ever been to Israel, you know that there's all sorts of wall posters in Hebrew. Well, some of the wall posters are funeral announcements. That's how they publicize funerals in Israel. Someone died, etc. Some of them are advertisements for either commercial or for shiurim or Torah classes. And some of them are excommunication bans. Just as we hereby declare, so-and-so. And some of them just not even any, some rabbinical organization you've never heard of that declares that somebody has communicated. And nobody listens to half of them. So the power of cheirin is very attenuated today. But when you had a centralized Jewish community, the cheirin was a very, very powerful weapon that could be used to put people in line. So the Vilna Gaon instituted a number of charamim, excommunications against the Hasidic movement, etc. This was in the late 1700s. As I mentioned, there were various rumors that on his deathbed he recanted and everything else, and he went out of his way to say, even when he was almost dying, he said he didn't recant. And some Hasidic guy went around saying he was the Vilna Gaon's son, and his father told him to be tshuva for this, and this was not his son, etc. So things were going on back and forth. I think I mentioned last week that they tried to retaliate in various petty ways. Apparently a complaint was filed with the Vilna regional government that the Vilna Gaon hadn't paid taxes for 20 years, so there was an investigation there. People are doing all sorts of crazy little things here. But what is very important is that the Rav Shneur Zalman, who we're going to talk about tonight, tried to meet with the Vilna Gaon twice to explain their philosophy. The Vilna Gaon refused to meet. Again, from our vantage point, it's hard to understand why he was so adamant in refusing, but he did refuse.
Did he ever meet with any
people? As far as we know, he did not. There were various stories, but it seems to be documented he just refused, which was a matter of grave, grave disappointment. The Vilna Gaon died in 1798, and the persecutions against the Hasidic movement did continue. But basically, by the second decade of the 19th century, everything kind of died down. Because what the Russian government did, and Russia at that time ruled over Poland, they simply basically authorized every group to form its own autonomous Jewish community. They didn't have to be under the same umbrella anymore, and they gave legal recognition to the Hasidic movements and to the Mitnagdim movements, and separate congregations were formed. Now, it's an interesting point that one of the later Hasidic Rebbes actually said that we owe a great gratitude, great debt of gratitude to the Vilna Gaon, because the Vilna Gaon's opposition prevented the Hasidic movement from going over the edge and breaking away from traditional Judaism. He said that what the Hasidic movement did in a large degree was they incorporated a lot of the criticisms in the Vilna Gaon. So for example, if the Vilna Gaon was fearful that there was a denigration of Talmud Torah, we find that the next generation of Hasidic rabbis stressed again the importance of study of text. If the Vilna Gaon felt that the emphasis on emotion was at the expense of halakha, the next movement, as the next group of rebbes, emphasized the importance of fidelity to halakha. We find in the next generation of Hasidic rabbis strong words against excessive tobacco smoking and drinking. Right? We find these were addressed. We find a greater commitment to tefillah in the proper times, etc. Now, some say that's a betrayal of the Hasidic movement's original agenda. It's walking away from it. But actually, what's interesting is that, in effect, the Hasidic movement incorporated much of the mitnaged criticism, but trying to keep the distinctive features of Hasidic, namely pnimiyut ha'avodah, but they also tried to recognize, which is why, for example, if you look at life today, and you ask yourself, which Jews are the most committed to the detailed observance of halakha, it is the Hasidic. They're the strictest. And yet the Vilna Gaon's criticism was, they're the ones who were throwing away the details. So to some degree, therefore, many have said that the Hasidim today behave like the Mitnagdim did 200 years ago. Meaning to say, they incorporated a lot of the criticism. So although there were rumors that when the Vilna Gaon died, many of the Hasidim rejoiced that their enemy was gone. But all of the great rebbes of the Hasidic movement, so we're very much against it. In fact, Rav Shneur Zalman of Yadi remarked, when the Vilna Gaon died, first of all, he said the bracha. I told you last week the story of the Berditchever, who said that the Vilna Gaon will never go to Gehenna because his Gemara will protect him. But Rav Shneur Zalman also recited the blessing of Vayano Emet, God is the true judge, which you recite when you lose a relative. And then he said, woe is me, because now my opposition will come from a higher source in heaven. Meaning to say, when the Vilna Gaon was on earth, he was fighting me with earthly weapons. Now he'll be in Shamayim, and he'll be a much harder adversary to deal with. And it was none other than Rav Shneur Zalman's grandson, who's a the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, a great scholar, who actually said a surprising statement that we have to be grateful to the Vilna Gaon because he restored the Hasidic movements to a full commitment to halachic Judaism. Now again, you might be looking at that and saying, well, maybe that's a betrayal of what the Baal Shem Tov intended. Maybe, but it certainly was a corrective that brought Hasidim back into the mainstream. So the truth is, this episode of real persecution against Hasidim was a very, very strong episode, but it lasted a fairly small number of years. They tell a joke to describe the process of why Hasidim and Mitnagdim don't fight as much today. Tell a story about a man that had rich man that was supporting two sons-in-law, right? So two people married his two daughters. And one person he supported by giving him a meat meal every day, a meal of meat, sorry. And the other person had the finest cheese and milk and cream. And the two sons-in-law were arguing over who was more important. Whether it's the meat meal a sign of greater importance, or is the dairy meal a sign of greater importance? You know, kosher cheese costs as much as kosher meat, which is it does cost almost the same, if not more. So anyway, eventually the person got poor. He really couldn't afford this anymore. So all he could serve was potatoes. But since he did commix, one would get meat, one would get milk, so the potatoes for one were made in the fleshy pot, in the meat pot, and the potatoes for one was made in the milk pot. So they're still arguing. And said, well, you know, my potatoes are made in the meat pot, and your potatoes are made in the milk pot. So the father-in-law calls them in one day and says, you know, you guys have to stop fighting. You know, when I gave you meat and I gave you milk, when there was a real difference, then there's something to fight about. But now it's all the same. One is a fleshik pot, one is a milchik pot. It's the same potatoes. Well, some have described that Hasidim and Mitnagdim, to some degree, we no longer have the meat versus the milk. We have the meat pot, somewhat of an emphasis. That's different. Now, I'm going to talk about this later on again, because what I want to say is the following. The fundamental distinctions within Jewry today are no longer along the Hasidic versus the Mitnagdic axis. That is not the division. Good, a Hasid dresses differently than a non-Hasid. But to say, is the belief system of a Hasidic Jew different than the belief system of a traditional Halachic Jew? The answer is very little difference. Some differences, externally in particular, but that's not the major difference. The major differences are between Halachic Jews and non-Halachic Jews, right? There are many Jews who don't acknowledge Halacha. That's a major difference. And even within Halachic Jews, we have issues regarding Zionism is a major issue, the Midinah, secular studies is a major issue. Mm-hmm. But you see, the cleavage line is not between the Hasid and the non-Hasid, but the division is in a different area. So, in effect, we could say that someone asked me before the class, why are there so many distinct Hasidic communities today? Like, do Sanzer Hasidim have different beliefs than Gerer Hasidim? Or what's the difference between a Gerer Chassid and a Bavur Chassid? There is no difference, theologically. Again, we'll talk about it in more detail. But obviously, once organizationally separate structures have developed, there's a self-perpetuating momentum in having a separate organization. You have your Rebbe, your person, your place, just like, for example, in any community there might be many Orthodox synagogues or many conservative synagogues. Why not just have one big conservative synagogue or one big Orthodox synagogue? Why don't you merge? Sometimes synagogues do merge. But there is a concept that if this is an institution that you've grown attached to and that you're fond of, you know, you want to keep it. So that may be disappointing to you, who expected maybe sharp ideological divisions. But there are much less. And in effect, the meat pot and dairy pot, I think, is a nice way of describing the process. And that process of normalization, ironically, was the response to the Vilna Gaon's bans on Hasidut, which to some degree mainstreamed the movement, it normalized the movement. Some felt there was a betrayal. Some felt that it lost its charisma at that early point. It lost some of the uniqueness of the movement. But in effect, it made it more acceptable to take roots. Now, a major, major person in that normalization is the person we're going to talk about tonight. Basically, we've been addressing to the disciples of the Mezuritcher Magid. We talk about Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. We talked about Rebbe Elimelech and Rav Zusha. Well, the fourth disciple I want to talk about is the first disciple who really founded a significant movement that exists to this very day, and that is Rav Shneur Zalman of the Adi. The Adi was a town in Russia. Rav Shneur Zalman was the youngest of the famous disciples of the Mezuritcher Magid, but he was the only one of them that we've mentioned so far who really founded a dynasty and a movement, and he is, of course, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. Although he did not live in Lubavitch, he really was not called Lubavitcher Rebbe, he is from Liadi, and later he moved to Lyozhna. It was his son that moved to the town of Lubavitch and started a kind of a dynasty there. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi has many names. He is called the Alter Rebbe, the old Rebbe, because he was the founder of Lubavitch. He is called the Baal HaTanya, the author of the book Tanya, which is his classic book on Jewish philosophy and mysticism. He is called the Rav. He's just called the Rav. And I should say, the Rav is not just a title that's used by Lubavitchers. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi is a universally respected thinker, quoted by all Hasidic movements and quoted by many Mitnagdim as well. If you read the writings of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who is a very distinguished member of an archly Mitnagdim family, he had a great affection for the works of the Alter Rebbe, for the Baal HaTanya. Of course, part of that is, he has a whole story, part of that is that unbeknownst to his father, when his father hired a tutor to teach him, he hired a Lubavitcher Chassid, who instead of teaching the Talmud, would sometimes spend time teaching him the writings of the Baal HaTanya. And when his father found out, he fired the guy, but nevertheless, that struck a certain responsive court. The Bala Tanya lived 1745 to 1813. Again, just to give you some comparative dates, you'll get a sense of the overlap. The Mezerich or Magid, the Magid of Mezerich, was 1704 to 1772. Okay, so he was 40 years older than the Bala Tanya. Rabbi Elimelech was the oldest disciple of the Magid. He was 1717 to 1786, and his brother Rav Zusha was 1718 to 1800. So they're not the same age group. They're not really the same generation as the Bala Tanya. But Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was 1740 to 1810. So he was really the colleague. In fact, they were very, very beloved friends, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev and Rav Schneer Zalman of Liadin. He was born into a mitnaged family. Of course, there really wasn't the Hasidic movements when he was born. He showed early signs of genius. For the first 18 years of his life, he studied by himself. There was no yeshiva, there was no academy, etc. He too, and it's very interesting, he was in Lithuania, and this is it almost sounds like the Vilna Gaon. He studied 18 hours a day. Two-thirds of his time would be Talmud, the normal Talmud. One-third of his time was Kabbalah and Zohar. He got married at a young age, but his father-in-law was very disappointed in him because his father-in-law thought that this young prodigy would become a prominent rabbi in the town and bring fame and fortune to his house. But all the guy wanted to do was sit and study Torah. He wasn't into any of these things. And the father-in-law wanted to force him out of the house, so he would not give him candles at night. And the story goes that Shter Zalman would study by the light of the moon. When he was 18, he finally decided he needed a master. He needed someone that he already mastered all the Talmud, but he needed someone that could teach him how to serve God properly. And he wasn't sure. There were two masters he had in mind at the age of 18. One was the Mezerich or Magid that he heard was teaching people how to serve God. And the other was the Vilna Gaon. So this person was on a pathway where he would either go to the Vilna Gaon to learn the Torah, or he would go to the Mezerich or Magid. He finally decided, one of those crucial life decisions that really changed religious history, he finally decided, well, the Vilna Gaon would teach me how to learn Talmud, but I know something of the Talmud already, so maybe that I kind of had done myself. But the Mezerich or Magid would teach me how to pray, because I've never really learned how to pray properly. So he went to the Mezerich or Magid. He studied with the Mezerich or Magid for 12 years. Again, I think we pointed this out. The Mezerich or Magid was kind of a recluse, had all of these disciples who lived in the house with him, 24 hours a day. They saw the way he ate, they slept, etc. And he spent 12 years, and he was the one that said that the Mezerich or Magid's house, there were miracles and divine inspiration everywhere, but no one had time to pick it up. He says, you could look under a bench and see miracles, but we were too busy. We couldn't do those. But there was this concept of total immersion. Total immersion in the day-to-day, in the minute-to-minute. The story goes that he was very young. He was the youngest of the disciples. And the Magid used to come out in the middle of the night, and he would have candles, and he would look at the faces of his sleeping disciples. And the story is recorded that as he walked by Rav Schneer Zalman, who was a young boy, 19-year-old boy, and he showed the candle in his sleeping face, he says, how could such a wonderful how could such a great Torah be in such a small body? He says he was really wondrous, because Rav Schneer Zalman was really one of the most learned. Remember, he was called the Litvak by the Magid. Remember, Lithuania had a strong tradition of Talmudic scholarship. Some of the Hasidic masters de-emphasized. When Rav Schneer Zalman came with a complete mastery of traditional Talmud. Remember, he could have gone to the Vilna Gaon, he would have been happy there. So he was called the Litvak. He was the Lithuanian Chassid, the one who combined a massive Torah knowledge with emotion and feeling. Anyway, what's interesting is that the Magid took Rav Schneer Zalman to be the tutor for the Magid's son. The Magid had a very interesting son. Let me tell you about him a little bit. The Magid of Mezerich was not succeeded by his son. His son died very young, at the age of 36. But the Magid of Mezerich had a son who was called Rav Avraham HaMalach. Abraham the Ancient. He was a person, as it were, that was very ascetic, against his own father's beliefs. A person who was very, very separated from the world, a great mystic, a greater recluse than his father was. And his father wanted him to get more involved in the world, and he hired Rav Shneur Zalman to be his son's tutor for 6 hours a day. And the deal was, for 3 hours, Rav Shneur Zalman would teach his son Talmud, and for 3 hours, Rav Avraham HaMalach would teach Rav Shneur Zalman Kabbalah. Because Rav Avraham HaMalach was a great mystic, but he was a little weaker in Talmud. Rav Shneur Zalman was a great Talmudist, and they would exchange it. So Rav Shneur Zalman used to say later that there was a clock that was marking off the hours, but Rav Avraham HaMalach was so involved, he never got to took track of the time. So whenever the clock was about to reach the designated hour, he would simply turn back the hour hands. And they kept going for most of the time. Anyway, this Rav Avraham HaMalach, there are a lot of interesting maisim about him, stories about him. The story goes that once a delegation of rabbis wanted to talk to him, wanted to get to know him a little bit, and one of the rabbis was kind of conceited and very proud about his Torah knowledge and was knocking at the door and saying, "Why are you keeping me waiting?" So he finally comes into Rav Avram's room and he sees Rav Avram is just staring at this mountain, this hill. And he says impatiently, "Why do you keep staring at that mountain? What do you see?" And Rav Avraham HaMalach turns to him and said, "I'm just amazed to see how such a lump of earth made much of itself till it grew into a tall mountain. And I'm just amazed when I see how a pile of dirt thinks it's a big mountain." Which is alluding, of course, to the person. Human beings are made of dirt and they think of themselves as great, powerful mountains. One story about Rav Avraham HaMalach is that after his death, after the Maggid of Meserich died, he appeared to his son in a dream, and he ordered him to give up his life of seclusion. He says, "I don't want you to be an ascetic anymore, it's not right. I order you to give it up." And Rav Avraham HaMalach replied to his father, I guess in his dream, says, "I don't accept a flesh and blood father. I only accept my father in heaven. I accept God, this is God's will." So the Meserich Maggid says, "You accepted the inheritance that I left you, so you acknowledge me as your father. How can you say I'm not your father?" So Rav Avraham HaMalach cries out and says, "I renounce the inheritance." Anyway, immediately as soon as he said that, the very few things that his father left him, the fire broke out of the house, and those things got burnt. Those things disappeared. Anyway, when Yom Kippur came around, his brother-in-law wanted to give him as a gift the Maggid's kippah that he used to wear, the white garment that's worn Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and Ram put it on before Yom Kippur, and of course, as you would expect, it caught fire with a candle, and it also just burned up. So the concept is he renounced his father's inheritance, so everything his father left him was taken away. There are a few stories about Ram's wife, how difficult it is to be married to such a man. The story goes, it's recorded in Hasidic Chronicles, I'm not sure if this could be verified, that the first time, when he entered the marriage chamber, so to speak, his appearance, his visage was so awesome that she fainted and she could not be revived for several days. There are times it is recorded that she had dreams of a group of angels sitting in heaven, and they're deciding, "Let's take him with us. He wants to be with us. He doesn't want to be here. He wants to be there." And she goes in front of the angels and she pleads and she pleads and she says, "Please, let him live, let him live, let him stay." And the angels finally say, with God's concurrence, "All right, we'll wait in 12 years. And the next morning, the Maggid sees her at breakfast and says, "Thank you very much for what you did last night." No way to get an awareness of her dream. And of course, Rav Avraham lived another 12 years. The story goes also that after her husband died at the age of 36, she had another dream about him where he went up to heaven and he said, "You know, I really have to make up to my wife because I really did not act like a husband towards a wife." And she cried out that, "I forgive you, I forgive you," and different things like that. So he was obviously not in a position to be any type of leader of any of those movements. But he was very, very close to Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and the fact that the Maggid asked Rav Shneur Zalman to be his son's teacher indicates the great love that Rav Shneur Zalman, the Maggid had for Rav Shneur Zalman. One little story about Rav Shneur Zalman's childhood which we know very little about his childhood. Because we know that for 18 years he basically studied by himself. But the story goes that at the age of 13, he demanded that he become a member of the Chevra Kadisha. And the Chevra Kadisha is a burial society. Now, in Jewish towns in Europe, and even it's still true to some degree in this country as well, it is a tremendous honor to be involved in preparing the dead for burial. Washing the dead, putting on the shrouds. It's a very, very great honor. It's called, in fact, Chevra Kadisha is Aramaic for a holy society. It's a very, very sacred task. And in Europe in particular, it only went to learned people, to very, very esteemed people. It certainly didn't go to bar mitzvah. In fact, he actually wanted to do it when he was 10 years old. He applied for 10, and we even have a whole record of the speech that he made and the proofs that he adduced that he could do it, etc. They finally decided that he could come along as a mascot, but he couldn't do anything at burial until he reached the age of 13. But he was admitted as a member of the Chevra Kadisha at the age of 13. Why is this important? It's important because when the Mezritcher Magid died in 1772, Rav Schneur Zalman was around 28 years old at the time, obviously his students wanted to be the ones who prepared his body for burial. But the mitnavim, who controlled the communal structures in those days, wanted to make a rule that they felt would exclude all the Hasidim by saying, no one can be involved in a Jewish burial unless they are a member of the Chevra Kadisha of their established community. None of the Hasidim were members of the Chevra Kadisha, but Rav Schneur Zalman had his membership card from his pre-Hasidic days. So in the Hasidic legend, the concept was because of what he did at age 13, he was the one person who was able to take care of the Mezritcher Magid's body upon his burial. Okay, but anyway, he went to the Magid, as it were. He did a lot of things. The Magid saw that he was the great Talmudist of the group, and he actually commissioned Rav Schneur Zalman to write a revision of the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish code of law, to incorporate all of the most recent opinions, etc. And he did in his 20s and early 30s. He wrote a modernized for 1790s, a modernized version of the Shulchan Aruch. And this is called the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Shulchan Aruch of the Rav. And again, it must be emphasized that this is, of course, a definitive work for Lubavitch Hasidic. But not only that, every major source of halakha utilizes the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. And one has to know that its tremendous strength is the lucidity of explanation, conceptualization. It is not a dry rule book. He was a wonderful writer. He was a very gifted thinker. He had an organized mind. He had a lucid power of exposition. Even today, if one wanted to understand an area of halakha, if you wanted to understand what are the concepts behind the laws of Shabbat, the laws of Kashrut, not just the rules, not just the do's and the don'ts, but a systematic understanding. To this day, it is one of the finest works that one can turn to. It is quoted by every Mitnaged source. The works of Lithuanian Mitnagdim, the Mishnah Brewer, for example, all quote very, very generously from the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. So this established his credentials as a world-class, as it were, not Mitnaged scholar, but a scholar of the caliber of the greatest of the Mitnagdim. And the Magid was very smart, because the Magid recognized that if he needed a spokesman who could defend the Hasidic movements against the attacks of the Vilna Gaon, the best person he could take was a Lithuanian who came from that same tradition. Because the Vilna Gaon would not respect anybody who was not learned, but the Rav Schneur Zalman was somebody who indeed could speak the Vilna Gaon language. The tragedy is, the Vilna Gaon refused to meet with him twice. He tried to meet with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon refused. Now perhaps, again, one might speculate, perhaps the Vilna Gaon was afraid that if he would meet with the Baal HaTanya, he would be unable, as it were, to condemn the Hasidic movement. But on the other hand, he also may have realized that the Baal HaTanya perhaps was not representative of the entirety of the movement, and therefore the Vilna Gaon may have said he was not the representative spokesman. But again, that's what's fascinating is that the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is not a work of Hasidic or mystical literature. It is a work of conceptual halakha that is cited by all authorities And this, I think the Maggid of Mezerich envisioned this as the entranceway, the entree, that would give Rav Shneur Zalman the credibility to be a spokesperson for the Hasidic movement.
It's not in English, is it?
No, it is not. It is not. But it's a very, very fine, fine, wonderful, wonderful work. Just, you know, if you open a Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch itself tends to be just rules.
Yeah, right.
But he gives life to them. He really shows you how it all fits in. Now, it's not an easy work. It's not, I mean, it presupposes a certain advanced level of Talmudic knowledge, but just a very, very flowing, well-written work. The other thing that's notable about the Alter Rebbe is that shortly after the Vilna Gaon died, and the Vilna Gaon died during Sukkot of 1798, the attacks against the Hasidic movement actually intensified over the next 10 years or so. And as a result, Rav Shneur Zalman was actually imprisoned in St. Petersburg in 1798, a few weeks after the Vilna Gaon's death. He was imprisoned from approximately the end of Sukkot to Hanukkah, or shortly before Hanukkah. In fact, he was released on the 19th of Kislev. Now, Hanukkah is the 25th of Kislev. And in fact, you may know, if you're familiar with Lubavitch Hasidics, they celebrate to this very day the 19th of Kislev. They call it the Rosh Hashanah L'Chasidut. It is the new year of Hasidut. It's a very important day. And the importance of that day is, that was the day that the Alter Rebbe was freed from prison. By the way, it also happens to be the...
What was the charge?
Yeah, I'll go to that. It also happens to be the Yahrzeit, the day of death of the Maggid of Mezerich, which they also consider that to be the significant day. He was the successor of the, and was that the day that he died. Now, what were the charges? Well, first of all, it's very interesting that the Alter Rebbe's legal name, you know, his name is Shneur Zalman, and of course the name Schneerson, that all the Lubavitcher Rebbe's have, Schneerson, meaning Schneer's son, Shneur Zalman's descendant. His last name was not Schneerson, he was Schneer, Zalman. He didn't have a last name, because last names were not in vogue then, but his legal name, for purposes of the investigation, he was called Zalman Baruchovich, because his father was Baruch, of Shneur Zalman ben Baruch. So in Russian, that's Baruchovich. In fact, we have the papers that are in the possession of Lubavitch Archives that talks about the indictment and the prosecution and the investigation of Rabbi Zalman Baruchovich.
What were the charges?
The charges were that he was conspiring to rebel against the Russian government. Now, those were very serious charges. Those were capital crimes. The concept was this. A group of the disciples of the Baal Shem Tov had made Aliyah in the mid-1700s. And they were not in Yerushalayim, they were in Tiberias. Now, Israel at the time, you know, Palestine at the time, was under the Ottoman Empire. It was under Turkish rule. So, as was true for all Hasidic movements, they wanted to give financial supports to the Hasidic Jews living in the land of Israel, and therefore money was sent to the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire at various points had hostilities with the Tsar. So if you wanted to trump up a charge against somebody, you could accuse him of sending aid to the enemy by financially supporting the Ottoman Empire, which was enemies of the Tsar. So he was actually accused of treason, and he was in prison for a number of months. He was also a secret in prison. It's, basically, his family did not know whether he was dead or alive. And within Lubavitch, there are many oral traditions. I mean, these have been written down eventually regarding all the different things that happened in the prison, etc., the various conversations. They have a tradition, for example, that the chief of police was actually was a baptized Jew, and because of the Balatanya's influence, he eventually returned to the faith of his fathers. There is one famous conversation, I think you may have heard this, which the Baal HaTanya had with the chief of police who was conducting the investigation. And the famous conversation was, the chief of police saw this was a holy man, and he said, I have a question in the Bible that's always bothered me. You know, I read the Bible. And in the beginning of Genesis,